Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We're starting with our study today of the Torah section called Vayishlach, or And He Sent. We're going to be going over Genesis chapter 32, verse 3 through 36. Now, as Yaakov went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Yaakov said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named the place Mahanim. Then Yaakov sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, 'Thus says your servant Yaakov, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight.'" The messengers returned to Yaakov, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Then Yaakov was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. For he said, "If Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape." Yaakov said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Yitzhak, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you,' I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant, for which my staff only I crossed this Jordan. And now I've become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother and from the hand of Esau. For I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, 'I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered.' So we spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, 'Pass on before me and put a space between the droves.' He commanded the one in front, saying, 'When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, "To whom do you belong? And where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong?" Then you shall say, "These belong to your servant Yaakov. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us." Then he commanded also the second and the third, and to those who followed the drove, saying, "After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, 'Behold, your servant Yaakov also is behind us. For he said, "I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me."' So the present passed on before him, while he himself spent the night in the camp. Now he arose the same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Yabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Then Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so that the socket of Yaakov's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Yaakov. He said, your name shall no longer be Yaakov, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Yaakov asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Yaakov named the place Peniel, because he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Yaakov's thigh in the sinew of the hip. Chapter 33. Then Yaakov lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. And he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah, her children, next, and then Rachel and Yosef last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? And he said, children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Yosef came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Yaakov said, no, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand. For I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. Then he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you. But he said to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail, and that the flocks and herds which are nursing and are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. Saul said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Yaakov journeyed to Sukkot and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is named Sukkot. Now Yaakov came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and camped before the city. He bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Eloi Yisrael. Chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Yaakov, went out to visit the daughters of the land. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her away and lay with her by force. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Yaakov, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young girl for a wife." Now Yaakov heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Yaakov kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Yaakov to speak with him. Now the sons of Yaakov came in from the field when they heard it. The men were grieved, and they were very angry, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Yaakov's daughter. For such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with him, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according to as you say to me. And give me the girl in marriage." But Yaakov's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition we will consent to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. The young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Yaakov's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are friendly with us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." All who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, and all who went out of the gate of the city. Now it came about on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Yaakov's sons, Shimon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unaware and killed every male. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Yaakov's sons came upon the slain and looted the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, and that which was in the city, that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in their houses. Then Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men are few in number. They will bring together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should we treat our sister as a harlot?" Chapter 35. Then God said to Yaakov, "Arise and go up to Beit El and live there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Yaakov said to his household and to all who were with him, Put away the foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Beit El, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak, which is near Shechem. As they approached, there was a great terror upon the cities which are around them. And they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Beit El, which is in the land of Canaan, and he and all the people were with him. He built an altar there, and he called the place El Beit El, because their God had revealed himself to him when he had fled from his brother. Now Devorah, Rivka's nurse, died, and she was buried below Beit El under the oak, and it was called Alon Bachut. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came to Padan Aram, and he blessed him. God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." Thus he called him Israel. So also God said to him, "I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and to Yitzhak, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you." Then God went up from there in the place where he had spoken with him. Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it. So Jacob named the place where God had spoken with him Beit El. Then they journeyed from Beit El, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrat. Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. When she was in severe labor, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for now you have another son." It came about as her soul was departing, for she died, that she named him Ben-Oni, but his father called him Ben-Yamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrat, that is, Beit Lechem. Jacob set up a pillar over a grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Adir. It came about while Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now there were 12 sons of Jacob, the sons of Leah: Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Shimon, and Levi, and Yehuda, and Issachar, and Zebulun. And the sons of Rachel: Yosef and Benjamin. And the sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, Dan, Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maid, Gad, and Asher. Then these are the sons of Yaakov who were born to him in Padan Aram. Yaakov came to his father Yitzhak at Mamre, at Kiryat Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Yitzhak had sojourned. Now the days of Yitzhak were 180 years. Yitzhak breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons Esau and Yaakov buried him. Chapter 36. Now these are the generations of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan: Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, and the granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and also Basemah, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. Adah bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemat bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Yeush and Yalam and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and daughters and all his household and his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods, which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to another land away from his brother Yaakov. For their property had become too great for them to live together. And the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. These are the records of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife Adah; Reuel, the son of Esau's wife Basemat. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Adah. These are the sons of Reuel: Nahat and Zerah, Shammah and Mizah. These were the sons of Esau's wife Basemat. These were the sons of Esau's wife Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah and the granddaughter of Zibeon. She bore to Esau Yeush and Yalam and Korah. These are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, are Chief Teman, Chief Omar, Chief Zepho, Chief Kenaz, Chief Korah, Chief Gatam, Chief Amalek. These are the chiefs descended from Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Adah. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son: Chief Nahat, Chief Zerah, Chief Shammah, Chief Mizah. These are the chiefs descended from Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Esau's wife Basemat. These are the sons of Esau's wife Oholibamah: Chief Yeush, Chief Yalam, Chief Korah. These are the chiefs descended from Esau's wife Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Esau, that is Edom, and these are their chiefs. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite, the inhabitants of the land: Lotan and Shobal, Zibeon and Anah, and Dishon and Azer and Dishon. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hammam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal: Alvan and Manahat, and Ebal and Shepho and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon: Aiah and Anah. He is the Anah who found the hot springs in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father Zibeon. These are the daughters of Anah: Dishon and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the daughters of Dishon: Hemdan, Eshban, and Itran, and Cheron. These are the sons of Ezer: Bilhan, Zaavan, and Akan. And these are the sons of Dishon: Uz and Aran. And these are the chiefs descended from the Horites: Chief Lotan, Chief Shobal, Chief Zibeon, Chief Anah, Chief Dishon, Chief Ezer, Chief Dishon. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, according to their various chiefs, in the land of Seir. Now these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the sons of Israel. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhabah. Then Bela died, and Joab, the son of Zerah and of Bozrah, became king in his place. Then Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites became king in his place. Then Husham died, and Hadan, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the field of Moab, became king in his place, and the name of his city is Avit. Then Hadad died, and Samlah of Masreka became king in his place. Then Samlah died, and Shaul of Rehoboth of the Euphrates River came, became king in his place. Then Shaul died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, became king in his place. Then Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar became king in his place. And the name of his city was Pau. And his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab. Now these are the names of the chiefs descended from Esau, according to their families and their localities by their names. Chief Timnah, Chief Alava, Chief Yetet, Chief Eliabama, Chief Elah, Chief Penon, Chief Kanaz, Chief Teman, Chief Mibzar, Chief Magdiel, Chief Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is Esau, the father of the Edomites, according to their habitations in the land of their possession. So that is the section that we're taking a look at today. One of the things that I always like to do as we go through this is to keep a mind on the big picture of what we're talking about here, some of the key points. One of the things that kind of keys into the Vayishlach, you know, and he sent, kind of the, one of the words in the opening passage that we're looking at today, and he sent. So Yaakov sent messengers. And one thing we've talked about before is about our being sent. And the Lord is sending all kinds of messengers out into the world. We'll talk a little bit more about that with the encounter that Yaakov has there at Bethel with a particular messenger. But one of those things that comes down to us, and you see that in Exodus 19, and then later when the Apostle Peter is reflecting on this, is that we're all called to be part of this kingdom of priests and the kingdom of God. So one question that we always should have in this is that, okay, what are we being sent to do? What is it? We talked in previous times about the legacy that we have. So what is it that we are doing with that legacy in whatever small part that we're given? Either maybe a small part, maybe a large part. And you know, as we'll see in some of the challenges that got faced in this particular passage that we're going along, how are we encountering these passages? Last time I was talking, went through a passage there from the Apostle Yaakov, often called James, and looked at chapter 1 and where he talks about, you know, facing challenges of many kinds and how that builds up perseverance. And how when we're praying for wisdom, one of the key things that we should be praying for wisdom about is what we do with these challenges when we meet them. And when we look at Yaakov's life, we're going to see a change in how he met challenges. So one of those things, these might be challenges of our own making, and when we face up to, as I say, face the music for the things that we have done, how do we approach that judgment that comes to us? You know, it could be judgment with the big J, or finally talk about the final judgment. How is it that we face up to that situation? That is of our own doing. But then how do we also face up with judgment that may not be of our own doing? Maybe not so much judgment, but discipline and building up of our endurance. Are we asking for wisdom when these problems and inconveniences and such come across us? Are we asking for wisdom? What is it that we should be getting out of this? How should we be reacting to this situation? And then something that we also see in this, and we'll see it in the uncomfortable chapter to talk about with chapter 34 of Genesis, with the whole incident with Dinah there in Shechem, there's a lot going on there that has been building up to this point and will continue on through the whole rest of the book of Genesis, that's about divisions and how these divisions come up. And you know, one of those things that you can see, and the apostles talk a lot about, is the spirit of division, the spirit of divisiveness. And that's something that kind of pops up in a interpersonal relationship, but it's one of those things that can be utterly toxic to not just in the body of Messiah, but in the world in general. I mean, we look about all the conflicts. I mean, right now we're worried about some particular countries going on. There's a divide between them and us. So what do you do about those divides? And a counsel here from the Apostle Paul there in Romans 12, verse 18, he says, you know, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. We're going to see as we go through this, there are some cases where you're trying to be at peace, but people are not being peaceful on the other side of that. So what is it that we do in those situations? How do we react to those situations? So kind of some big picture topics so far. So we kind of move on into chapter 32, kind of a reiteration of some of what we looked at in a previous discussion when we were going through Yaakov and Esau and with the the red stuff. So they talked about the guy who's full of red, and in the passage we looked at today, it spells out particular. Esau is Edom. He is red. The red guy. The guy, as we were kind of talking about with red and what its associations with, you know, blood, lifeblood, with the flesh. And as you see, the apostles kind of build that idea up. What you see between Esau and Yaakov, battle between the spirit and the flesh. And in one of those cases, we'll see in this, and especially in chapter 32, a little bit of the overcoming of the flesh to a certain degree. And you'll see that with it's kind of interesting in Esau's line, this kind of, it almost looks like a, like, I don't know, you call it like a pendulum swinging between, or, you know, dispute resolution, reconciliation, and division, and kind of swinging between those extremes throughout Esau's history, and later Edom, and kind of taking on that mountain, taking on the mountain of division, the mountain of hairiness, Seir, that which is prickly. So, continuing on in another kind of vocabulary term that we come across is the Melakim. Melakim, or the messengers, which could be translated angels, that we have in there. One of those things that you see is that it's referred to, and it's one of those things where context matters. Context matters to figure out which are we talking about. Are we talking about human messengers? Are we talking about celestial messengers? You know, people from heaven? What is it that we're actually referring to here? And, you know, as you probably read sages, over thousands of years they've been wrestling with this, you know, which of these messengers are we actually talking about? So, one of the things that we are really left with, and again, when it comes down, you see, so you got these Melachim, but then you also have the Mechanim. Got divided into the camps. Got two camps divided up into it. And there's all kinds of different ways that people have taken this to be, well, what is this pointing toward? A lot of people have seen various ways that this can be taken as to be whether you're splitting of Israel up into eventually the two final kingdoms, because, you know, people have looked at, well, which wives and sons were sent in particular parts. You know, of course, you know, Rachel was kept close, and Rachel is where Yosef comes from, and then you also have the other sons with Leah out in front. So you get, even though divided up into two camps, you get even further divisions from there. Yes. Oh, we have a comment down here, a question.
I was wondering why there's a contention about whether he sent heavenly or human. It just says he sent messengers. Why is there any consideration that he sent other than just some of his men?
Well, One thing that some sages have said is because of Esau's reaction. The reaction at the other end is like, wow, you know, how long has Yaakov been on the run? 2 decades? And then they come back together with all of the stuff that's become because of that. And Esau embraces him. So some people thought, well, there had to be some sort of divine help involved to have this sea change in Esau's life. So that's just, I guess, one example is that, well, when it talks about sent messengers back and forth, there was this an interaction between, you know, the heaven and mankind. So not saying it has to be, but that is just one idea, because they're looking at this and it's like, wow, this is a huge change in Esau's life. That's, you know, he went from really being angry about them looking to kill him, which is why Yaakov ran and left town, to now wanting to embrace him. So it was a big, big change you see in Yaakov's life and his reaction to his brother, and then you also see a change in Esau's life and how he approached his brother again. So that's just, yeah, it'd been 20 years, you might say, that things that they're brothers and they last, and you can get over it.
Esau's not a bad guy.
Yeah, Esau, you not mention a bad guy, and you see that at the end of the account that we're, or near the end of the account in chapter 35, where you have this coming together again, because they both come to bury their father. So you have that coming together again. So that's what I was saying. In Esau, Edom's life, you get this kind of pendulum swing back and forth between reconciliation and division and animosity, you might say, kind of utter hatred and, you know, looking to take you out. And previous discussion we've seen in the history of Edom, they went from being accommodating to, you know, during the Exodus, to, you know, selling them out and actually attacking them and, you know, having border disputes, and finally, you know, King Dawid had to actually subjugate them at one particular point in time. So it was a pendulum swing back and forth, which it's kind of interesting as we talk about, you know, Paul, when he goes on and on about the spirit battling the flesh and back and forth and back and forth. It is almost kind of an interesting thing to juxtapose that battle that we have within ourselves with the battle that seemed to be within Esau and Edom as a culture, as a nation, going back and forth, being kind of in, being out, part of the family, fighting against the family. It's a really quite a thing. So that's why it was one of the things to have an overarching look at this is about division and the reverberations that come from the division that came in the family. So one of the things also kind of moving on from this is we see in a portion of Genesis chapter 32, verses 9 through 12, when Yaakov is praying, he's praying there for the God of my father, Abraham, and of my father, Yitzhak. So we talked about legacy, kind of praying to fully take on this legacy that comes. And then you see as we go through chapter 32, this transfer, you might say, this fully taking on the maturity of it, comes to a head. He literally wrestles with it. Literally wrestles with taking this legacy on. And something that we talked about in the previous time when we were going through this particular passage is that Yosef and Moshe and Yeshua and Peter and Stephan, they all go on and they talk about using this phrase, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, and the God of Yaakov. That's a thing that they keep talking about again and again and again, about when you hear God's promise, the name, what his the description there, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Yaakov, is important in when you talk about these promises. And I know we talked about that in a previous discussion. We're gonna kind of move on to another topic today. But if you want to go at this in depth, we covered this. And if you just go to hillel.info/ But Yishlach, yeah, that's probably the most difficult one to come across. -Genesis-2015. We talked about that a lot in depth because those particular people really went on and connected this, especially when you talked about in like the Apostle Peter, when he's kind of giving his sermon there in the book of Acts. What is an important thing that he brings up about this name? The God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Yaakov. What is so important that the Apostle Peter brings out about this? Not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. So, these three people are hugely important and continue to be important because, yes, they're no longer here, but God's promise to continue this line on through them continues on to this very day. And as we see with the whole promise, you know, that Abraham got a taste of with Yitzhak, and it's reflected there in Hebrews chapter 11, that he believed that God could bring this promise through Yitzhak, even if he had to bring him back from the dead. So this promise that the Lord would continue people on and keep the memory of them, and then at some time in the future will bring life back and bring the resurrection back. That idea of God of the living, not the God of death, not the God of destruction. And one of those things that we're talking about, the pendulum swinging back and forth between you know, reconciliation and, you could say, division and destruction, animosity, that kind of thing, is a picture that you see, and we're talking about this is a revelation, this is a testimony of the Lord to mankind. What is this testimony that we are getting throughout Scripture, even as we're continuing on through here in Genesis, that we just talked about? Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov. Abraham called out. The Lord called him out. And continued to line on with Yitzhak. Special. Special. He was a child of promise to a barren mother and originally. Then you could say, quote, given back to life there on the mountain. And then to Yaakov. And the promise that was given him. It was a promise that almost got sidetracked and went to his older brother. But it was one that was supposed to go to him. And one that you see, he literally wrestled with in coming forth to a conclusion. So, one of the, getting on to the question of, kind of starting with the outset of, is with whom did Yaakov wrestle? So, with all of the stuff that he had accumulated over all that time, he had all this stuff that he had accumulated. So, he was now going up to meet Esau. But in this one case, we thought about the division between the Machanim. He was divided up into the two camps. One was going to have all the stuff, the other with the things that were precious. So it was kind of an interesting division there between the stuff and the stuff that's and the people who are precious between them. But one of the things that people have always wrestled with this one about is some of the troubling aspects when you start looking at this particular encounter and who or what this person was that wrestled with him. You know, people have looked at this as saying, you know, it looks pretty, in the plain reading of this, that he was wrestling with God. There's a lot of words in there, you know, I've seen the face of God and survived. And in the, if you're saying, well, okay, well, say, for example, that he is seeing God face to face. Well, the language there seems to indicate that this person who's wrestling with is seems to be overcome at some point in time and has to, you know, basically pull out the celestial trump card and basically takes out his leg to, quote, win and get away. And then you also see this account there of, well, okay, the dawn is breaking and this darkness, kind of shadowy, not being able to conceal the wrestler anymore, then he has to get away. Which, you know, you start sounding like things from ancient mythology where you would have the mist of the night would disperse and break up in the coming dawn. So a lot of this stuff has kind of troubled people over time and say, well, okay, the big old 50-cent word of theophany, you have a appearance of God here on earth. Is that a comment over there?
So two thoughts. One, just my opinion, how I view it. One is that as far as the God, you know, the dawn's coming, I gotta go away. Well, you gotta point it out to Moses that no man had seen his face, and obviously Moses was not dealing directly with God, the Creator, but he's very Messiah as far as how the rest of the Bible instructs. So in this instance. Also, it appears that it's not that he's afraid of the sunlight, like a vampire. He created it, after all. But rather, to not see his face, because that's what's an important thing with God. But the other thought, which is, I can't remember the guy who wrote it. Somebody else discussed this years and years ago, was that using, even though an angel, as Hosea pointed out, but using it as calling it God is an important part. And that not so much about the character of who Jacob was fighting with, but rather, what did Jacob do? So you're fighting with God. What did Jacob, instead of running away, he clung on to him. I mean, how many of you have been punished by your parents at some point in time? Now, sometimes, yeah, most of us did at some point. We were mad, we run away, or do we cling to them? And I think it shows a character, it shows in Jacob the character who he is. He realizes, yeah, God, it's going to be hard walking with you, but I'm going to cling to you anyway. It's almost like showing what love truly is of the character Jacob has. That's why I like about the story. It shows more about Jacob as opposed to necessarily the being he's struggling with, you know?
And that brings up a very good point, because one of the, you could say, a heart revelation of who God is seen in the book of Devarim or Deuteronomy. And one of those curious comments that's made in Deuteronomy pretty early on is what? To cleave to the Lord your God. To cleave to Him. And when we always get these allusions, these references back to things we've seen before. So that imagery of holding on to, just grasping on to, holding on to the Lord God is really a very, you could say, a personal look. It's a personal testimony of who the Lord really is. So as we're seeing this revelation of the character of the Lord, is it the character of the kingdom of God about reconciliation, or is it about destruction? Reconciliation or destruction? Now, one of those things that we had seen with the recommendation from the Apostle Paul there in Romans chapter 12, as far as it's in the possibility for you, live at peace with other people. One of the things we're going to get to it here shortly is that you will see a testimony of the Lord God that is exactly the way the kingdom of God is working throughout history. As far as it can be within the kingdom of God, trying to live at peace with everybody. But the sad part is, when you see the revelations of the day of the Lord, that is the other side of it. Well, what happens if the rest don't want to live at peace with the kingdom of God anymore? What indeed happens at that point? No place for them. Do you just like have the eternal quarantine, or what? Then do you do with that situation? So we're going to see a little bit more of that as we move along through this account. But It is really interesting when we take a look at this account in Hosea chapter 12 that we see a little bit more of this. And this is the first six verses of Hosea chapter 12. Ephraim feeds on wind and pursues the east wind continually. He multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Mitzrayim. The Lord also has a dispute with Yehuda, and will punish Yaakov according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Beit El, and there he spoke with us. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore, return to your God, observe kindness and justice, and wait for your God continually. So, what we see here is a lot of the difference between these two, between Esau and between Yaakov. That's a kind of a difference in character. And I love this, how the prophet is talking about growing to maturity. And that's one of the things we had talked about when we were going through the passage from the Apostle Yaakov in James chapter 1. That process toward maturity. Something that we see revealed here in these accounts of Yaakov and Esau. Yes?
It says there that he wrestled with the angel, not with God.
Yep. But one of the things we always have to remember is with Hebrew, especially in this section, as you might kind of notice, that a lot of Bibles still leave in the capital letters where you have new lines begin in Hebrew. And so this is Hebrew poetry. And one of the characteristics of Hebrew poetry is what they call parallelism. There's one word of it, is where you'll have, especially when you read Psalms, it'll look like, it sounds repetitive over and over again. They'll say one thing and they'll say almost exactly the same thing on the next line. Well, that's one of the nice things about it, because there are some Hebrew words where we would have no idea what they meant if it weren't for parallelism, because you'll have one obscure word that's used only once, and then the line above it will say almost exactly the same thing, use a word that is used a lot. So we can sort of guess at what the meaning of the word that's hardly ever used is. So one nice thing about parallelism, but another nice thing is with this we sort of get a zeroing in on what the meaning of this is. So in this case, it's talking about maturity when he contended with God and then wrestled with the angel. So the meaning of did he contend with God or did he wrestle with an angel? Yes. Yes. That's the answer. Yes. So I'm talking about, and this is into a bigger discussion of, when we get into Exodus and such, and we'll encounter the angel of the Lord. The angel of the Lord is even more curious, because as you see the angel of the Lord used throughout it, especially when you see in the prophets, are you talking about the Lord or are you talking about the angel of the Lord? Yes. That's something you also get out of that. How do we explain that? Don't know. How do we explain the eternally begotten of the Father, Yeshua, Messiah? How do we explain that one? It just says that's the way it is. One purpose. Yeah. So that is the one thing to keep in mind, but that also kind of reflects a difference that you'll see throughout the history of these two groups of people. The line of Esau, the line of Yaakov, pursuing violence, multiplies lies and violence, and making covenants, but then you also covenants with surrounding powers and the enemies of Israel. But as we'll get to in a moment, you'll see that wasn't just exclusively a problem with the line of Esau and Edom. It's also a problem with later on with Israel and its divisions of the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel. So kind of an interesting point with that. So as you see in chapter 33, you have the final reuniting after the 20 years, the buildup of it. And it seems kind of curious, well, We use the term, well, women and children first, you know, because we want to, when you're evacuating a ship, let those that may not be capable of helping themselves, you know, have the first crack at safety. Well, in this case, it's reversed. Basically, shove off, you know, all your stuff, and then all the women and children first, and then you follow at the end of it. It's like, okay, wow, instead of the general leading from the front, he's all the way at the back. He's in the armchair back at the headquarters while everybody else is doing the dirty work. But what you see as we kind of look at this, the pendulum swing back of reconciliation versus judgment and contention, division, is this is sign of reconciliation. This is a sign of, we call it coming with your hat in your hands, coming with a sign of repentance, a sign of, hey, this is, I'm a different kind of person. Well, with this, this is a sign to his brother, hey, I am leaving myself vulnerable to you. I am putting myself at your mercy. I'm putting the most, you could say, some of the most cherished stuff, my children, all at your mercy. So, Esau, what are you going to do about it? What is it that you are going to do about it? And in a sense, you see this repeated again and again. Well, what happens during the Exodus? The descendants of Esau also have the choice again. Here comes Israel through them. Are you going to let us pass? We'll pay for whatever it is that we take, food, water, whatever, but are you going to let us go? Then later on in history, they're faced with it again. Descendants of Esau, of Edom, what are you going to do when Israel's left in a very vulnerable condition? What are you going to do about it? Are you going to attack? Are you going to embrace and help? So, one of those things that's mentioned there in chapter 33, verses 4 through 11, you know, Yaakov makes this very curious point when he talks about, you know, Esau, looking at you is like, in various ways you can translate this, it's like either looking at the face of God or it's as if I've seen the face of God. Yes.
Well, it was your earlier question about, you know, when you're down, when Israel's a vulnerable place, what are you going to do? And it's funny, funny is, and it's interesting to watch as you look through history, even modern day history, and what the descendants of Esau and Ishmael do when Israel is at a weakened point. The riots of 1948, just the horrible things they've done, it shows the character of what a person truly is. And I think that's a reason why Esau also, as it says, he despised his birthright. Which the birthright was God, essentially was the birthright. That's how I view it. And it shows that that character quality is so vitally important. And that's why God chose the other son. Because Yaakov didn't have the same character inside him as Esau did. And why one was more, far more desirable than the other.
And, you know, I'm sorry, let's, before we go on.
It's kind of more mundane, but I could, when I was reading it, I noticed that he had set the women out in front, but then it seems like when they actually came upon Esau, he went over and went out in front and bowed down to Esau.
Yeah, seven
everybody
times.
Everybody behind him, right?
Seven times.
So he was, I mean, it makes sense. If you put the women and children out, if the guy's mad at you, he's probably not going to hurt the women and children. He's probably looking for you, right?
That would just take everything.
But then he
didn't come looking for
you. He might take them anyway, but he's not going to kill them probably. So, but then it says he passed over in front of them and then bowed down to Esau.
Yes.
So he actually did go out in front.
Yeah,
after all
finally
that.
At the end of it, you know, because his brothers say, well, what is all this stuff?
Yeah.
And that bowing down seven times is really like, you know, that we talked in previous times about the significance of seven and in realm of its connection with the word like oath and such. You are making a firm, complete saying, I am completely giving you respect, completely subservient to you in this. Just like, and it's very interesting. One way that you could take this, like seeing your face, Esau, is like seeing the face of God. I've seen the face of God and lived. I was completely at the mercy of Esau and I lived. I was in his face and yet lived. So, one of those things that we see in this is also kind of made me think when he was talking about seeing the face of God and what is your response when you are face to face with the creator of heaven and earth. Is this kind of a good thing that you go forward, or is it a thing that is going to destroy you? And one example that we kind of have there is in Revelation chapter 6, when we're talking about the opening of the sixth seal. And this is something, verses 12 through 17 of chapter 6, that really is a good parallel to what we're seeing here in the life of Yaakov and Esau. And Yaakov's approach when, number one, he was face-to-face with God, and then face-to-face with Esau, face-to-face with judgment coming toward him. I looked, and he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. The sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island removed out of their places. Then the kings of the earth and the great men of the, and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come. And who's able to stand? And who is able to stand when you come to that particular day? What is your reaction going to be? Is it going to be like with Yaakov? And it's like you cling to the Lord even when you're looks like you're in an incredibly dangerous position. And later acknowledges, hey, I've seen the Lord face to face and lived. So he definitely came to the realization that it was touch and go for him. This was not something he could just waltz up and expect what the outcome was going to be. Now, always when you look in the book of Revelation, there is a lot, quote, under the hood of Revelation, and a lot of it comes from the prophets. And when you see kind of the details of everything we just looked at in this passage, there's a lot of places where this comes from, and talked about and details of it. You know, Isaiah chapter 2, and chapter 13, chapter 34, chapter 50, Jeremiah 4, Joel chapter 2, 4, and 3. Those are kind of talking about the moon turning to blood and then the sun being darkened a lot. Nahum chapter 1, Haggai chapter 2, then Matthew chapters 4 and Luke chapter 23. You could say the apocalyptic passages from the Messiah as he was talking about what the day of the Lord was going to be like. Now, one thing to kind of zero in on this, in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 10 through 12, really focuses in on the aspect of people saying, hey, hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 10 through 12 says, enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled. And the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. So when you talk about what is the attitude of Yaakov when he was facing the Lord and then facing Esau, what was he? Talked about the bowing seven times. What is that the sign of? Proud man? Or the one who was considering himself abased? Lower. Lower. Even though he was the one, Yaakov was the one that prophesied to get the birthright, then actually did get the birthright and got the blessing, yet he was coming to his brother in a position of humility, of considering himself lower. And one of the things when you're always looking at a prophetic passage is context is always key. When you look at the whole chapter of Isaiah chapter 2, one of the things that you see the prophet Yeshayahu talking about in this chapter is he's speaking to the house of Yaakov and telling them, they're right at the beginning of the chapter 2, to telling them to walk in the light of the Lord. Walk in the light of the Lord. So what would that imply? They were walking in darkness. So not walking in the ways of the Lord, you're walking in darkness. So telling them, hey, come back into the ways of the light of the Lord. Rather than in verses 6 through 9 of chapter 2 in Isaiah, then start detailing how far into darkness they've gone. About chasing after teachings from the east and the mystery revealers from Philistia, reveling in riches, worshiping idols, and trusting in chariots and the war horses of the nation. So to keep your nation safe, you've got all your military hardware. All the good that will do fighting against the kingdom of God. But trusting in that as being the source of your safety. So the problem that Yeshayahu was addressing and what you saw Yaakov encountering and what Esau was battling with his pendulum swing back and forth, is pride. Pride in what mankind can do and conceive of. And when you see that thing in Revelation chapter 6, the breaking apart, you know, it talks about mountains, islands, things that you think are not going to move, things that you think are solid. I mean, you talk about NORAD, or North American, you know, Defense Command, in Cheyenne Mountain, buried deep in a mountain, because you think, well, the mountain's not going to go anywhere if you bomb it and this and that and the other. Well, yeah, we've taken down quite a few mountains in some places here in recent years, so mountains aren't as stable as they used to be, but big mountains, the whole mountain range, is still pretty secure. That's not going to go anywhere. But some of the imagery that you have around the day of the war, the Lord, is that, wow, those things that you really trust in as being secure, from mountains to military hardware, the horses, chariots, war horses, not so secure as you think they are. And those things that you trust in, the gold, the silver, the words of wisdom from some other place besides God, not so secure, not so trustworthy anymore. That's, it kind of gets down to what we've been talking about ever since Genesis chapter 3, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Where are you going to get your knowledge from? Are you going to get your knowledge from the source of life, the source of all that exists? Or are you going to look somewhere else for it? You're going to hope that it comes from somewhere else, that that is now the source of everything. Chapter 34. Ouch. This is a not so pleasant topic to talk about, but it reflects something that has been, you know, brewing for big chunks of the book of Genesis here so far. And as we look in this account, one of the, again, the key things I think to look at before looking into the really unsavory things further is that this really shows that division that you have within a family, within a group, within a body, if you let it fester, it will grow and take over and become really a cancerous thing that starts to destroy how the body operates. And, you know, just as a bit of a refresher that it brings up in the beginning part of Genesis chapter 34, is that Dinah was the daughter of Leah. And in our previous parasha, what did we learn about Leah? She was the most loved, called the unloved one, the less loved, is especially the kind of the really heart-wrenching one there in Genesis 29:32, is where she says, after she's had all these kids, finally, Yaakov will love me. Finally, after having these kids, then Yaakov will love me. But Yaakov's love was toward one who could not have any kids. And that love persisted. So, Dinah coming from mother not loved. And then you also look at Shimon and Levi, older brothers of Dinah. And they were also from the unloved mother. So you had a bunch of kids from the unloved mother, and it progressed on. So kind of like when you look at the family line here of the four women here in the life of Yaakov, you got Leah, and from Yaakov, she had Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Issachar, Zebulun, and Dinah. And from the handmaids, Bilhah, you had Dan and Naphtali. From the handmaid Zilpah, you had God and Asher. And from Rachel, in this part, we're talking about Yosef. In the end part of the parasha, you have Benjamin comes onto the scene. So when you see this family, there's a whole lot of the family that's, whether you talk about all of the sons of Leah plus the sons of Zilpah, which are, you know, Leah's handmaid, and likely handmaids may talk and such. You got this connection to the unloved portion of it. And, well, when you see, where is Yehuda? Is in the line of Leah. So when you see that, the scepter coming through the line of Yehuda. But one of the things that we see out of all of this is what is a big portion of the family? Unloved. Unloved. So what language do you see in this passage in chapter 34? What language do you see that's related to a kind of a hiccup in the family and how it operates in chapter 34 of Genesis? Favorites and non-favorites? What happens, you know, when you have Yaakov, when he hears about this? Did nothing. Waited for the kids to get home. And it took the older brothers to actually do something about this, to actually move forward with it. Now, when you talk, yes, we have a question back there.
Well, Daniel kind of discussed this, was it last week? About how around this time the brothers were in charge of their sister. Mm-hmm. Because in case the dad, for some reason, passed on, the brothers knew what to do with the sister or with the younger siblings, with the land and with the riches.
That's always a good idea. If it weren't for Absalom being another... Absalom is another example of what went wrong in this situation here in chapter 34. So, one of the things that we see in this discussion of the unloved portion of this is, what did the father do? What did the father not do? The father did nothing. But what then, it's kind of interesting to see the fathers in the story. What did Shechem's father do?
There's an old saying that nature abhors a vacuum.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
So, for me, I don't find it a profound issue that Jacob waited for his sons to get home, particularly the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
But even after they came home, what did he do? Nothing. That's the problem. But yet you see the reverse with Shechem and Hamor, where Shechem does this thing. He, you know, molests this girl. He rapes this girl. And so it's Hamor that basically, in a lot of ways, he's the one that takes the lead, you know, in convincing, helping convince everybody to go along with the whole thing. So he actually is a little bit more of, even though in a lot of ways, Shechem probably is the primary one involved in it, but Hamor actually is walking alongside him to work it all out. Whereas it seems with Jacob, even after the sons come home, he doesn't give them any guidance that we can see about what to do, what they should do with the situation. And so the sons take it upon themselves to make their own call on what to do with the situation. And it didn't turn out the way Jacob wanted.
Yeah. Yes.
I think Hamor took on because later on, when he's greed, yeah, because later on he's talking about like, well, if we do this, then we get all their stuff too. So,
yeah.
Earlier, Jared, that basically the older sons were in training on, you know, managing things as mm-hmm. their father. I mean, that's what you do when you raise your kids. You teach them how things are done.
Yeah.
And so that was typical.
Well, one of the things that you had Hamor teach. Now, let's just change a little bit of some of the scenarios here and see if the story sounds familiar. Change out Dinah for a vineyard. Now, what does that sound like? Someone really wanted a vineyard. Oh, he couldn't get the vineyard. Ah! Oh. Yeah. That's Jezebel, yes. And so you have Jezebel being the the little bit more of the mediator, the schemer, and that one even far as you know going and wiping out the owner of the vineyard to get it. So that one is another bad example of it's like, oh yeah, you abhor a vacuum. But also, people like to throw out the term enabler, and it's kind of like defangs it to the situation of, you know, it looks like you're trying to make people happy by giving them what they want, but in this real situation, what you're doing is you are a gasoline thrower is probably more, you had a situation, you got something that's burning, it's on fire, what do you do? Do you get an extinguisher or do you throw gasoline?
Gasoline!
The gasoline, yes, right. So in the case of, you know, the father in this case was Shechem, threw gasoline on it. I mean, what? And it sounds like in kind of modern parlance, who was wearing the pants of the family, actually? And even in the city-state that we're talking about, was Shechem. Well, kind of the guy who associated his name. It's Shechem. He was the guy who was actually in charge there. You might say, well, you know, he was the one kind of training to run it. Well, where in history do you really hear about that? You hear occasionally you've got regents who sort of are regents in charge. In fact, you know, some cases you got some of the ones of Persia who you had kind of dual leaders in cases. But not often do you end up having before the parent, the father dies, that the son is actually in charge. Especially when you're talking about in royalty. What? David and Solomon. Yeah. And just dysfunctional families.
That's a very common thing, and I don't think it's ever been uncommon.
Where you have the children in charge?
Yes, or the younger sibling, or just anybody who takes up the responsibility that is laid down by the one who's supposed to have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Messiah does that and taking up the charge of it. Yeah. But you could say that he was delegated that to take on this role, and you know, he talks about it's all power and authority has been given to me to do this and to do that. But you know, what she was talking about with the dysfunction there is that you don't have those who are truly supposed to be guiding the situation actually guiding the situation. So thus, you have, you might say, people doing what they want to without the actual wisdom guiding it. Yes.
In an example of the discussion we're having here, granted, when it comes to kings, kings typically never lay down their authority.
No, until they're dead.
Until they're dead. Even then, they still question, they try to prevent it. So, and when it comes to a king in charge of a city, in charge of many, many people and powers like that, in particular pagan ones, you're never going to get them to say, oh, here, son, go take care of my work for me. That doesn't happen. Now, when it comes to the patriarchs and the Torah, was how ordinary people lived, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, I read a story to my kids not too long ago. It's about some the nomads in the desert of North Africa about 1,500 years ago, and it discusses how the family patriarch worked versus his sons worked, and just how the nomads ran their lives. And he's in charge. The dad's in charge, except on certain things. And he's okay, son, the oldest son. What do you want to do? Okay, we'll go do that. So he wasn't a king, though. He wasn't in charge of here are my 500 people and the millions of dollars I'm in. He wasn't a king. He was just a family leader. And I think when it comes to, and I'm not saying that story was necessarily the end-all, be-all example. The point is that I think that is more likely a common scenario when it comes to a family structure over a king structure. And we have Hamor and Shechem. That's a king-based system. He's not going to give up his authority until probably long after he's dead, much less while he's still alive. But the examples you get with the patriarchs, in at least a number of them, it shows that they are relinquishing certain authorities to their kids as they go along, and not just patriarchs, but as also the generations continue on in years, with Aaron and with Moses, they're kind of relinquishing control, even though they're not dead yet, they're still passing it on as they're going. I think that was the idea, the symbol that God probably wanted to instill in our minds, that was the intent. I mean, I look at my personal family. So my father's getting much older, as his mind is not as strong as it once was. And he's relinquished certain controls that he maintained of his affairs because he's not as good at taking care of them anymore. And a lot of older men, mothers too, realize that, okay, at some point, I can't do this anymore. I need help. I mean, that's probably the intent of the imagery that we get from these examples. But you're right in the fact that kings, there's no way a pagan king would ever do that. Even the pharaohs, they hated the idea of it, even though they still did it sometimes semi. It was a funky system, but that's what kings do because power corrupts, and power always will corrupt. It's the nature of kings. So, it's just my two cents.
But one of the things to why I bring this up and continue on with this is that this is what you see between, you know, Hamor and Shechem, and the unrestrained passions of the son being enabled, being basically intensified by the father, and not, you know, saying dealt with this as, you know, as you saw in some of the earlier parashas we've gone through, that what was the, you know, the various leaders called Abimelech? How would they have reacted to this kind of situation? How did they, is it recorded that they reacted with any of hint of this kind of a situation? They're like, wow, had we known that, you know, she was your wife and this and that, we would have never done anything with her. But since you said that she's your sister, we didn't know that there was this boundary. But we're like, okay, we're coming up to a boundary here. We're not going to go across it. And this was a foreign power. Well, here we have in this situation where the father's not going, wow, you just like, you know, not just like, oh, wow, she's nice, go get her for me. Well, where is she in this all? This isn't like, okay, get her as a wife and then, you know, send her back and then we'll get her. Well, we're back in. No, she's captive. She's captive there in the city until her brothers go get her out. So she's captive in this. So One of those things that you might say in scaling up from this, this is an example of what happens within a person, within a family, within a city, within a nation, kind of going scaling up and up and up and up. The things that you want to do, the impulses that you have, is your authority figure restraining it or fueling it? Which is it? And when we keep talking about going back and forth between the spirit and the flesh, which one's in the driver's seat? You know, which one's in the driver's seat? You know, is the spirit just kind of like, you know, hanging on the back of the car as it's whipping along and, you know, has no control over whatsoever as it just careens and takes down people all over the place? Or is the spirit controlling the flesh? You know, slapping its hand every time it reaches for the steering wheel. What is actually in control here? So, it's kind of an interesting little vignette in this, and you see that in some of the response, as we talked about with the fathers to this egregious thing that happened. At the example there in 2 Samuel chapter 13, we just mentioned between, you know, David and Tamar and Amnon and Absalom. And interesting that his name means, you know, father of peace. Did not actually bring peace and later on, really rebellion, but quite an interesting thing of, well, father, why didn't you actually do something? You had this hugely terrible thing, breakdown of barriers within our family, and yet you did absolutely nothing. Yeah, and then they got mad at Absalom when he stepped forward and, you know, was vigilante about it and took care of it in his own head. But one of the things to look at as we go further on this is the, now getting into some of the unsavory parts of this, but one of the things that is mentioned of what Shechem did to Dinah is it talks about that by force. And the word there in Hebrew is anah. And anah, you might remember, as we talked about during Yom Kippur, you were supposed to anah yourself on Yom Kippur. You were supposed to humble yourself, bring low. So with Shechem, we have, this is the example of not what you're supposed to do in man and woman becoming echad. Man and woman become echad. Not by force. Because notice the sequence of events here. Because we have, you know, kind of go into the account, when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivites, prince of land, saw her, impulse, took her, lay with her by force, he lay with her in humbling her, then he was deeply attracted to her. And he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. And it literally says there in Hebrew, he spoke to her heart. Okay. You know, is this what you're talking about when having a relationship between people? That I want it, you're not going to give it to me, so then I take it by force. I humble you. I humiliate you, and then speak tenderly to you, saying, now you really want this. No, you really want this. So kind of make you happy with the great travesty that it is that has actually happened here. So as we kind of look at this situation, one of the things, what is it? It's like you can't, the news, and I work in the news business, and it's like, it is like a, you know, like a giant sewer main has opened, and it's just, the effluent is flowing out just day after day after day of all these public people that, you know, literally have been caught with in various states of disclothing. Disclosure, yes, there's lots of disclosure going on. So, in one of these things, what is a common denominator? You see this. It's almost the same thing of what we're talking about in this particular story. Humiliation. Yeah, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. Pride, lust.
Using your power to dominate someone or something else.
Yes, using your power.
That's
to
what
dominate.
They're doing. It doesn't matter whether you're using your power to dominate your wife, your children, the secretary, the whoever. You're using your authority and power, and you're saying, "Look how strong I am! I can make you do this." It's a manipulation. It's a very horrible way of doing things, and there are some people that are like that. And it doesn't matter whether the person's somebody on top of the country in charge of the world, or a wife beater next door. They're all the same. It's using your power to dominate someone else. This might be male or female. The idea of using your power to dominate, it's truly evil, because God reprimands again and again and again the Israelites in the minor prophets about that very topic. You are oppressing and dominating everybody else. This is a horrible, evil thing, and I'm going to kill you for it. And he goes after them. And they use oppression in lots of different ways, but it's still using your power to dominate someone else.
It even goes back to that section that we just looked at earlier in Revelation chapter 6. I mean, just think about that phrase, wrath of the Lamb. I mean, that phrase is so oxymoronic, it's not even crazy. What do you not think of when you think of a lamb? Wrath. You know, lamb, you think of, oh, nice and cute and fuzzy and stuff like that, very innocent and vulnerable. But when we talk about the lamb, well, what does the imagery of the lamb even go back to? You know, if you want to take it back to the garden, possibly, but specifically, what is the lamb referring to? Pesach. Pesach is a key place where you see a lamb showing up. Could be a goat too, but lamb is often the key symbol that's factored in with Pesach. So, what is Pesach about? Vulnerability. But the vulnerability stops the destroyer. What is more powerful? The blood of the lamb or the destroyer? The blood of the lamb. The destroyer was sent by the Lord, and the lamb was called for by the Lord. But what can the destroyer not touch? Those who are covered, the household that's covered by the blood of the lamb, cannot destroy it. Does that give a clue into what the character of God is like? And we're talking about the pendulum swing back and forth. Where is the kingdom of the Lord? On the reconciliation side of it. And we talked about the whole kind of huge clashing contrast between, you know, Genesis chapter 3 and the two becoming one flesh. And this scene here, total disconnect of what you could say the passions unrestrained, what that would do. I want it. I'm going to take it by force. Is that the testimony that we have of the creator of heaven and earth? I want your submission, so I'm going to take it by force. Quite different from what the actual testimony of the creator of heaven and earth is. So, in this sense, we get an interesting picture of how these commands that we have about our personal life are a true reflection of the testimony. We're going to talk about the tablets of the testimony, being the Ten Commandments and such on there, and radiating out into all the rest of the law of God. But these are things that, speaking to our heart, yes, speaking to our condition of our heart. As we were talking about with what the prophet said and what Revelation connects there, about what is it that the Lord is looking for? A humble heart, a contrite heart, and not a proud heart. A heart that knows where everything comes from, where the source of wisdom and knowledge and everything is. You know, not the heart that wants to dominate, humiliate, destroy, take, seize. That is quite a different picture. So, you know, when you ever have your elevator conversation, you know, oh, who is God? One of the key things that we can talk about is, you know, God is love and not squishy love, you know, grab anything you can kind of love. This is a love that self-sacrifices. And you see that, particularly when we're going back to the whole conversation of the angel of the Lord, this picture of God being wanting to be so much with mankind that keeps showing up here, showing up there, showing up here, leading people out, leading them through the desert, giving them water when they need it, giving them food when they need it, giving their daily bread when they need it, leading on and showing up. And then specifically showing up in even a more, you could say, abased and ana state, humbled himself to become flesh. The Word became flesh. Because some of those instances where you see the instances of the Word of the Lord and the Spirit of the Lord, and you see some of those combined with the angel of the Lord, and in some of the ancient translations, they would sometimes translate those instances as, especially the Word of the Lord, as the Mamre, which, you know, if you take it back over into what the correlation would be in a Greek version, that would be the Logos of the Word. And what do we see in John chapter 1 in that gospel? That the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Even though the Word was with God and the Word was God, that the Word became flesh. The Word humbled himself and became flesh and was even subject to ridicule, physical punishment, attack. Yet all of that was to do what? To reconcile. Reconciling the world to himself. So the great testimony that we have of the Creator of heaven and earth is reflected here in this account that we're looking at today between Yaakov and Esau. It's a great reflection of a heart change that comes. Heart change that comes between peoples, within a family, even within yourself, to, you could say, become at peace with those things that are raging with inside you. Which one is actually going to gain dominance? That which seeks to dominate and destroy, or that which seeks to reconcile and grow closer? So, with all of us, as a part of the commonwealth of Israel, part of the commonwealth of those who struggle with God, and as we saw there in Hosea, to actually prevail, what do we want to get out of prevailing in our struggling with God? Closer to him, to cleave to him, that in our, quote, victory over God, unquote, the Lord actually makes us conquerors. We conquer, we overcome, we are overcomers over our old way of life. To be able to walk in his light, stop running around in darkness after the things that just drag us down. To be more obedient. But one of those things about obedience is, you know, it's one of the things that's mentioned about Messiah is that, you know, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. And that's kind of what the Apostle Yaakov was mentioning there, and that suffering through these trials we face builds endurance. And that endurance matures us and makes us perfect, not lacking anything anymore. And how we get there is to just keep going to the true tree of knowledge of good and evil, the true source of that, which is the Lord. So as we close out today, any last thoughts? Yes, we have a last thought down here.
Our society for many, many years has been just gradually moving more and more into a parent-child relationship. They want a sugar daddy. You see it in the parenting that is going on, entitlement that people have. And when you're talking about relationship with the Almighty, you're talking about responsibility. And you can't have a relationship if you have a gimme attitude all the time. Husbands and wives, they won't make it if they're constantly expecting the other to do all the work and just take care of them all the time. You see that in our society now, people that want the government to basically spoon feed them. And, you know, partaking in the sufferings of Messiah is how we move in relationship with him. We connect with him. We walk with him. We experience to a very small degree the suffering that he experienced. That's part of how we're just even grafted into him. And it makes the relationship so much more valuable. I mean, it just makes sense. But that's not what people want to hear. They want to be spoon-fed. They don't want to get up actively and do the work that is required. And that's what we need to do. There's requirements to walk in relationship. And God has his requirements for us. And it's a true blessing to be able to walk in those things, even though it means suffering a lot.
Yeah, and truly to figure out with the suffering what it is you're supposed to learn from it. You know, that's always the big challenge that I always face when I encounter things that are quite difficult to get through, is that, you know, am I just like gritting my teeth to get through it? Or am I going to get through it and actually learn from it? To actually learn why it is that I may be in the situation. To learn also why it is that I should continue following what he says. Is that? Yes. Yes. He who endures to the end will be saved. Yes. Looking at that history of the Jewish community.
They have endured and they have survived through so much. And, you know, it comes right down to the fact that no matter what I'm suffering, that God's with me. Messiah is with me. Everybody goes through stuff. Everybody. Some go through it without him, and some go through it with him. And am I going to believe that he's with me? Am I going to have that trusting faithfulness to not budge and just run to him regardless of how painful or uncomfortable it is, and know that he's working things to my good, whether I can see it or not? Or am I going to get depressed and fall off reason?
Yeah. I mean, yes.
Something about what she said about how the Jewish people have endured, not really a comment or a question, but I think I'm taking Sharon's job here. What do the Jewish community and the soap operas have in common?
What's that?
They just never end.
Oh, oh boy. On that note, let's close with prayer. Father, sorry.
For the more brilliant of the two of your minds, where is everybody? Where is everybody?
Where is it?
Here.
I don't know. People are sick. Who knows?
Huh?
People are sick. A lot of people are sick. Don't know.
You don't know?
Well, let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us your words, and we thank you for giving us your Spirit. We thank you for helping us to understand. And Father, in the times that we don't understand why these things are happening, we just ask for your wisdom and also for the perseverance to keep going, not to give up if we don't understand or we don't like what it is we do understand. Father, we thank you for this testimony that you've given us, that you want us to be in a deep relationship with you. Guide us into having these relationships with those around us, that we can truly be your light, the light of the Lord in the world around us. And Father, in the midst of this darkness, we pray for your soon coming, whether it's in our lifetime or sometime else, that the death and destruction, the lies, the corruption, all of that will come to an end. Father, we look forward to that day. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.